Welcome to Meliora Mindset. Today I talked to Janet Gamble. I'm really excited to share this episode with you guys for a couple different reasons. First off is Janet has a really cool competitive background in athletics. She was an Olympic swimmer. So that's towards the beginning of the episode. And now Janet is a professor at MSU. And towards the end, she just gives some really practical places to start. If you have no idea where to start with your own nutrition, where to even get counseling if you need that. So I really am excited for this episode because there just is a lot of things towards the end that are just very practical that you can work into your life if you don't know where to start with your nutrition. So yeah, hope you guys enjoy the episode. All right, people, welcome to Meliora Mindset. I am with Janet Gamble, the wife of Ed, who was on the first episode. Say hello.
Hi, Nick.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Good. Yes, I'm really excited to have her on the podcast today. Her and her husband both don't typically share a lot about them, so selfishly I want to explore their life and share that Janet is an Olympian. To everyone's shock when I share that information. I don't know if you know that, but when I'm talking to people in class and we're talking about the Gambles and I mention that, everyone is just like, she never says anything about it. I think in our heads we just imagine that people would be more public about it.
Yeah, it's something that it's just, I've never really, I guess, shared with somebody.
Yeah.
It's something that I did in my life, and I personally am proud of what I accomplished, but it's, you know, I feel, if it comes up in conversation, I'll share it, but if it doesn't, you know, that's okay.
It's not necessarily something that you're holding back.
Correct, yeah.
Okay, well, let's start about what you're doing now. Like, what is your job?
Okay, so right now I am an instructor at Montana State University. I teach in the nutrition department. I'm also a registered dietitian. And then I have a part-time admin position as well on campus, and that's kind of what I do.
Sure. And you like it?
I love it.
Good. So I guess I want to start off a conversation with your athletic background. I am so fascinated how I think that the concept of being humble is difficult, right? I think people will often talk about being humble and just really downplay their accomplishments. And what I see in you actually is a good balance of being humble. I think being humble is thinking of your accomplishments honestly. And even as we're starting this conversation, this is what I'm noticing. It's not like a downplay of what's happened, but it's like, yeah, this has happened. This is part of my story. And I think that's really cool. Mm-hmm. But what I want to ask is, how did you get to that point, to the Olympics? Like, what did your athletic background look as a kid, growing up? Obviously, swimming.
Yes, obviously, yeah. So I started out in a whole bunch of different sports. You know, I played softball, I played soccer, kind of the standard, typical kid sport kinds of things, tried gymnastics. And then it was always a really big thing in my family to sit down and watch the Olympics every time they came around. And so in 1988, going back a few decades here, there was two Canadian girls that were synchronized swimmers. And they won gold. And I was in love. I was like, this is my destiny. I'm going to be the next synchronized swimmer. And so that fall, my mom and dad enrolled me in synchronized swimming. And I discovered quickly that I didn't work well in a team setting. And I also spent more time swimming by myself than actually participating in the routine. And so my coach at that time, actually, she's the one that suggested to my mother, she's like, have you thought about putting her in speed swimming? And my mom said no. I didn't even know what it was at the time. And so we made the switch that spring, and I guess I never really looked back.
Sure.
Yeah.
What is my question? What did that look like? What age were you when you made that transition to speed swimming?
Yeah, so I was 9 years old. I grew up in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada, and so I swam with a local club there until I left to go to university. I swam all through high school. Canada's a little bit different in that we don't have high school swimming, and so I swam club all through high school. And I would say at that point in time, I knew I was a good swimmer. I didn't know where that would take me. I qualified for my first Olympic trials when I was 16, and that was very eye-opening. That was the first time that I sort of went to a really big meet and I guess swam with the big boys, as they say. And then when I left for university, I obviously switched coaches, and I had a very cool working relationship with the coach at McMaster University. And we worked really well together. He changed a lot with my stroke. And I had made the national team within the first year that I was there, and knew at that point in time that the Olympics was, it certainly wasn't a guaranteed, but it was a possibility. And so in 2000, Olympic trials were in April, and yeah, I went and I swam and I made the 4x100 freestyle relay team, and was off to Sydney a couple months later.
What year is that?
2000.
2000.
Mm-hmm.
I would have been 6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So
I'm old.
I'm sorry to remind you of that. I'm sorry. Anyway, that's really cool. So as far as your relationship with your coach, was that strictly just programming? Like, how did that relationship look as you were being coached by this guy?
Yeah, so swimmers train a lot. I was in the water, let's see, I have to think back here now, 9 to 10 times per week. So I usually did twice a day. So I would swim in the morning for 1.5 to 2 hours. I'd swim in the afternoon for 1.5 to 2 hours. And then sometimes there'd be 3 a days where I'd go to the gym, you know, around noon. And so with swimming, a coach is always responsible for all of the training of the athlete. So my coach was responsible for all of the workouts that I did, my training, making sure that I was peaking when I was supposed to, tapering, all that kind of stuff. The swim team itself probably had close to 40 people, I'd say, 20 females, 20 males. And so he was ultimately responsible for everybody. And although swimming's not a team sport, you train together, you know, so there would always be people in my lane, but it's very much an individual sport in that you compete by yourself. And so, yeah, you know, he was responsible for getting me to where I ended up.
Yeah. And we talked about this before we started recording, but was there any part of like a mental aspect of him being your coach?
I wouldn't say necessarily, other than the fact that I knew he believed I could do it.
Mm-hmm.
We did have, as athletes at the university, access to sports psychologists and that kind of thing. It honestly never worked very well for me. I wasn't somebody that was really good at visualizing. I either kind of, it was a feeling I had, I just knew I was ready to go. So we did have access to that sort of stuff. I wouldn't say my coach was the person that was responsible for that, but he obviously was very much in my head. You know, I could hear him when I was swimming telling me, you know, adjust this, fix that, you know, so he was sort of constantly there.
So I think there's something to be said about just the mental aspect that you have, just as far as being an Olympian and being able to swim in the Olympics. And I know that before we started recording, we talked about the difference between you and Ed, but for you, what does that mental training look like, or what did it when you're an Olympian?
I think it was just a lot of, this is a good question. I don't know. I think it was a lot of, there was some intrinsic part of me that knew that if I worked hard and did everything that I could, it was a possibility and I was capable of it. And for me too, I think my goal was a little bit different in that I wanted to go to the Olympics. That was my goal. My goal wasn't to win a gold medal at the Olympics. My goal was, I want to make the team. I want to walk in and represent Canada in opening ceremonies. I want to be in the village. I want to experience what it's like to be at the Olympics for 2 weeks. And so that was always just kind of, I thought about that every single day for a really long time. And I think that just became part of my life. You know, that was my job at that point in time, and that's what I did.
Yeah. I think something, too, that I want to ask is, as you're a competitor in swimming, the thing that I always hear about swimming is it's the best workout for your body, right? You use every muscle. Yes. I think these are like my friends in high school that were swimmers that told me these things. Being a competitor in swimming, what toll did that take on your body, if any?
Well, you're correct. Swimming is a full body sport. And it's very repetitive. It's incredibly repetitive. I think, fairly lucky in that when I was swimming, I didn't have any major injuries. You know, there was a lot of fatigue. There was a lot of times where I didn't want to get out of bed just because I was tired. My body was tired. But I didn't have any injuries per se. You know, shoulders are a really common injury, knees for those that swim breaststroke, just because of the way the legs are moving. And so I was really lucky on that front. I'm starting to wonder, you know, I'm starting to get a little creaky and there's a little arthritis that's starting to show up. So I'm wondering now if my body's maybe a little tired of what I did 20 years ago. But I think I was very lucky. Other than the usual, I think, fatigue that goes along with training like that, I was never injured.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the reason I ask that is because I wasn't much into team sports growing up, but obviously I wanted to be competitive in CrossFit for a while, mm-hmm. and it felt like I was going to die all the time. It just felt so shitty all the time. Any kind of lifting, you'd go into a lifting session, you'd be like, I feel like dog shit, but I'm going to do this anyway. Because, mm-hmm. Again, at that time, that was on your mind. Yeah. You want to go to the Olympics. Yeah. At that time, I was like, I want to go to regionals until that died, but mm-hmm. it just made me curious.
Oh, yeah, it was, there were... I will confess, I rarely went to school during my first degree. I slept a lot. I ate a lot.
Hopefully none of your students listen to this.
Hopefully not. That's okay. I redeemed myself. It does take a toll, you know, and there were days that I did not want to go to the pool and I had horrible workouts, but I was there because that's what I had to do.
As far as you wanting to go to the Olympics, having that being on your mind so far, after you made it, what happened? What happened mentally?
I came home.
Yeah, you came home practically, but did that do anything? I feel like someone that has such a big goal like that, that had lived it for so long. I mean, I think you hear these stories on Facebook, social media. I mean, probably inflated a little bit.
Yeah.
But what did you experience any kind of loss of meaning or something?
I don't think I did personally. There was definitely a downtime, mm-hmm. for sure, you know, because the Olympics is a pretty big global event and there's a lot going on when you live in the village and you're surrounded by all of these elite athletes. And so to come home from that and to just have to go back into sort of normal life, I had to go back to classes and it was a change. I was lucky in that I went to the Olympics 2 years into my undergraduate degree, so I still had 2 years that I continued to compete after the Olympics for my university. And so it's not like I just stopped cold turkey, mm-hmm. and didn't have anything to do with myself. And so, I mean, it was a natural letdown just because of the hype around going to the Olympics, but I feel like I settled into life after the Olympics pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What made you not want to compete in the Olympics again? Or did you?
No, that's a good question. I didn't. My goal was to go. And I did. And for me, my personality, I was totally fine with that.
Cool. So you just really experienced that like downward slope until...
Mm-hmm. Yep. So I competed for my university another 2 years. And then I graduated. And at that point, I'd met Ed. And...
Bless his heart.
And we were off. We moved, we went to Japan right away after we graduated. And so that kind of led me to my new life.
Japan, I feel like I don't know this part.
Oh, yeah, we lived in Japan for a year.
Doing what?
We taught English. So he worked for the government and I worked for a private company. And
I feel like this did not come up in our pod. I'm really upset about it. This is like classic Ed to leave out information like that. The whole story, like when he shared his story, he was like, well, I'm from here, went to Canada, and now I'm in Bozeman. I was like, no, please give me detail. I care about these things. It was so frustrating. Cool. I'm glad that I know those details, and I'm glad that everyone else can know them now.
Yeah, we've done lots of cool things.
Sure.
Yeah.
So that leaves you now as a professor at MSU. Yeah. And something that I want to talk to you today about is I talked to Ed, obviously. The story is that when Ed was in class one day and I called Janet, a nutritionist, and he said, there's a difference between dietetics and nutrition. And I looked at Ed and I said, that's Janet Gamble coming out of you. That is your wife. So I want to talk about what is that difference. I have no idea. I don't even know
where to
start.
It's a fair question. And you're not different than, I'd say, most of the people in the general population. It's a term that gets used interchangeably, but they are quite different. So being a registered dietitian, probably the biggest difference between that and a nutritionist is that the term RD is protected by law. And so,
which is what you are.
Which is what I am.
Okay.
Yeah. So backing up, I guess, a little bit, in order to become a registered dietitian, you have to, I guess, first complete an undergraduate degree in foods and nutrition. And that degree has to be accredited by the governing body for dietetics in the country. You then have to apply and be accepted into an internship program, which can vary from institution to institution, but usually around 1 to 2 years. There is a board exam that you have to sit and write in order to become a registered dietitian, and then there's continuing ed units. And then that term, ultimately, like I said, is protected by law. Mm-hmm. The term nutritionist, generally speaking, is not protected in any way whatsoever. So you need no formal training, education, or experience to call yourself a nutritionist. Some states in the United States protect the word nutritionist as well, so you can become a licensed nutritionist as well as a registered dietitian, but that's not the case in all states. And so I'd say that's sort of the big difference, is that protection of the term.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not to say that you can't be very well educated in the field of nutrition. There are many other designations and courses that you can take. And there's a lot of nutritionists out there that are very well educated. I'd say the second big difference that maybe people aren't necessarily aware of is that dietitians are able to help in the diagnosis and treatment of disease states, whereas a nutritionist is not licensed to do that.
Okay.
So a dietitian would probably help, for example, say diagnose somebody with an eating disorder, and or they would be involved in the program planning and the meal planning for, say, somebody that has diabetes, whether it's type 1 or type 2. A nutritionist wouldn't be able or allowed to do that.
Okay.
So that's sort of, I guess, the difference.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
What made you want to... Is it possible to be a nutritionist academically? Does that question make sense?
Yes. I think so, if I understand. And I mean, would say no.
Okay. So then what made you pick that path in academics?
So, I guess backing up again.
You're good.
After I stopped swimming, I actually went into education. Mm-hmm. And so Ed and I traveled with that too. And then I got my master's degree in Australia. And I came back and I taught high school for a number of years and I had a great time. I loved it. And then the opportunity presented itself to go back to school. And I kind of sort of evaluated my life. I knew I really liked teaching. I've also just always loved food. And I thought, well, you know what? If I could figure out how to teach about just food, I'd be pretty happy. And so I went back to school and became a dietitian.
Did that ever include any, or does it, has it ever, will it include counseling other people in nutrition or dietetics? Did I just interchange it? Does it make sense?
No, it's okay.
Okay. I'm just curious.
It's okay. For me, probably not. But yes, so in dietetics, there's also typically three main areas of dietetics. So there's clinical dietitians. You would probably find them in a clinical setting. So say a hospital, right? So you will have dietitians on the wards that look after the patients, or an inpatient type setting. Diabetes clinics are a really good example of that. There's also food service dietitians. So they're typically found in institutions where there's large scale meal planning happening. So prisons, universities, hospitals. Mm-hmm. And then there's community dietitians. They're typically found in government positions. They're involved in a lot of program policy planning. You'd have dietitians with, say, the Women, Infants, and Children program, or WIC. And so those are sort of the three main areas. Counseling typically occurs at the clinical level and probably the community level. And I could, if I went into either of those, or went those routes, but I'm pretty happy in the education side of things, because I get to talk about food all day. And mm-hmm. So I personally don't counsel, but a dietitian would.
Could.
Yeah.
You have the ability to.
Yes.
What about nutrition and dietetics are you most passionate about? What about it specifically?
Goodness. This is a good question. Tough question.
You're good.
I love food. I love the power of food. I think food has so many potential benefits in so many areas of life, but I also think people are scared of food and they don't understand food. And so my hope is that, through my interactions with my students, that I can start to open their eyes a little bit to the benefits of food, that food can be wonderful, and to try to just bring that passion into their life.
What do you find that people are afraid of in food?
All sorts of things. People are afraid of cooking. I have a lot of students who've never had to cook before in their lives. And if you don't know how to cook, I think one thing that's really missing in our education system is we can talk about what it means to eat nutritious food, but you have to be able to prepare that nutritious food. And if you've never had to pick up a knife before and cut up a carrot, that can be really intimidating.
Yeah.
Or if you don't know how to read a recipe, it's just easier. And we live in a world where food is convenient, and so you don't have to cook. And so I think that's one thing. There's the personal relationship that people have with food. And from that side of things, food can be scary, with, disordered eating habits. And so I just want people to recognize that it's what nourishes us. It's what keeps us alive, and it can make you feel so good.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of...
I really like that answer. That's really cool, actually. My question is, how does that play into when you're teaching a student? When you're in lecture, per se.
Yeah. So I think I like to think I'm the kind of person I think I'm... I hope I am. I have a fairly balanced perspective on food, and I hope that just comes across in my lectures. I think you can go too far both ways, on both the healthy end and the unhealthy end, and I think it's really important to be able to come to that middle ground where it's okay to have a piece of pie,
mm-hmm.
right? And you don't feel guilty about it, but it's also that piece of pie is part of a healthy, well-balanced diet
mm-hmm.
at the end of the day. And so I hope that that's what I'm able to bring across, is that there is a balance and there is a middle ground. And how do we make choices to get there?
Mm-hmm. Let's imagine you as a clinical dietitian real quick.
Okay.
I feel like you might have some of these answers.
Oh, maybe I don't. I don't like clinical dietitians.
No, that's okay.
To be honest.
As you think about, or like even say like Ed,
mm-hmm.
say Ed is really struggling with food.
Mm-hmm.
I don't imagine he does.
No.
that doesn't strike me as a problem that he has. But if he was, with some of these fears that you're talking about, not knowing how to do it, or like the relationship, how would you even start to counsel someone on that?
Yeah, so I think depending on, you know, what that fear is and where it's coming from, I also have to be realistic with my skill set. So, you know, somebody that just wants to learn more about food, say, when you go to the grocery store, what kinds of foods do I look for when I'm at the grocery store? How do I cook, meal planning, meal prep? That's something that I personally would be very comfortable helping somebody with. When you start to get into issues around fear of consuming food, I would refer to a dietitian who specifically deals with disordered eating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I don't have the training or the skill set to deal with that.
Yeah. So then my question is, how do you do those things? The first thing I did after I was a freshman in college at MSU, I moved into a house for the summer. I walked into Rosar's and I was like, I have no idea what to do. Mm-hmm. I called my mom, was like, please tell me what I need to buy because I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure her answer probably is not even that good, honestly. I mean, I grew up with a family that was kind of overweight. Like, we didn't really think about what we ate a lot. And when I say kind of, we were. But how would you counsel someone in that? So I'm calling you Janet Gamble. I just left the dorms as a freshman. What are you going to tell me when I'm asking you on the phone so overwhelmed by everything?
Absolutely. And that's a good question. It sort of depends on where you are and the resources that exist in a city. Sometimes grocery stores will have dietitians attached to them. So you can always ask, you know, at the information desk at the grocery store, do you have or is there a dietitian that works with you here at the grocery store? And if they do or they don't, another question that you can ask is, do you do grocery store tours? Because sometimes that's really helpful if you just know where things are in the grocery store, right? Like, this is where I find, this is your fruits and your vegetables, your grains are going to be down this aisle.
That's a real option?
Mm-hmm. Yep. What? And to be honest, I actually don't know if it's an option here in Bozeman.
Oh, yeah.
I've never looked into that, but in Canada, it's a very real option. Looking for resources at a university as well, community-based programs, so reaching out through extension is an option. Also, you know, reaching out to a faculty on campus and say, hey, you know what, I am a freshman, I am moving out on my own for the first time, I don't know the first thing about going to the grocery store, can you give me some help? There's also a ton of resources online that you can access, you know, and depending, sometimes, you know, people are just willing to help and kind of point you in the right direction.
As far as you being a expert in this field, what would you tell someone personally? If someone was
in terms of what?
Just if they knew you. Imagine your child is leaving the dorms for the first time and they call you. They're like, mom, please help me. What are you going to tell them?
So I think making a meal plan for the week it's a tough thing for people to do, but it's also a good resource. You know, so if you can kind of sit down and plan out your week in terms of, you know, I'm going to have this for dinner on Monday night, and that'll give me leftovers for lunch on Tuesday. I might do this on Tuesday night. I'll do this, you know, if you plan your meals out for the week and then make a list of the things that you need for those meals, it makes going to the grocery store so much easier because you know exactly what you're looking for. You also don't tend to put things in your grocery cart that you don't need, like the ice creams and the potato chips.
Or the pumpkin chocolate chip cookies from Rosa's. They're amazing.
They're really good, yeah.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
I love them so much. They're really good. And you tend to also not have as much food waste at the end of the week if you have a menu and a list that goes with that menu.
What would you say to someone who feels like anxiety about that? I mean, because even as I feel like I'm fairly literate as far as grocery shopping and knowing what I need.
Absolutely.
But when you're talking about that, I get a sense of anxiety, actually. Like, it makes me anxious to, like, sit down and...
and I'm sure people are like, she does that? Yeah. That's weird.
So how would you counsel someone in that?
I think a big thing with food in any aspect is making a shift, making baby steps, right? So if this is something that you're brand new at, I guess going into it cold turkey is, it can cause anxiety, mm-hmm. right? So try one day a week, you know, say, okay, on Monday, I'm going to plan out my dinner and this is what I need for my dinner and start there. Right. Mm-hmm. It's one meal. You can also, you know, if you know that there's somebody that you're really comfortable with at the grocery store, go with a friend,
mm-hmm.
you know, find something that's going to make you comfortable while you're there,
yeah.
and make it a pleasant experience. Right. It always crushes me when people are like, I hate grocery shopping. I'm like, how can you hate grocery shopping? It's so amazing. There's so much food and choice. And I know why that stresses some people out, but making those little shifts, like picking one small thing and trying to do that for 1 week or 2 weeks or whatever it happens to be. Setting those little personal goals for yourself that you know are realistic and attainable and that you can do make these transitions, I think, so much easier.
When you're talking to someone, so that anxious person you're talking about, what does it look like to do your Monday night dinner? When you're talking to that person,
mm-hmm.
what is your general outline of what that dinner should look like?
That's going to kind of depend on the person and what they eat, their cooking skills, their capabilities, what they're willing to do in the kitchen.
So let's even say like someone that does not, that's uncomfortable and probably wants to lose weight. I want to know the answer for that kind of person.
Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, having a plate that has more whole foods on it
mm-hmm.
is probably something that I would encourage. So, you know, your whole vegetables, your whole fruits, your whole grains. But again, it sort of depends on the person and their comfort level with cooking. You know, so there are healthy options out there that don't involve a lot of meal prep. And so getting an idea of what they'd be willing to do would probably be where I would start, and then we'd kind of go from there.
What about someone who has pushbacks for like thinking that, I'm sure this is something you've experienced,
mm-hmm.
eating whole foods is expensive. What about that pushback? What do you think about that?
It can and it can't be. Mm-hmm. It sort of depends on what you're buying. Sometimes buying things in bulk is cheaper, sometimes it's not. You really, unfortunately, have to do your work and look around,
mm-hmm.
for sure. You can eat very healthy on a budget. There are resources out there. One of the projects that I do with my students, it's a third year class, is they have to eat on $4 a day for 3 days. Because that's what the basic allotments are for SNAP in the country. So it works out to about $4 per day. And so I challenged my students to see if they can do this for 3 days. And there's some really good resources out there in terms of grocery shopping and lists and menus to meet that $4 a day meal plan.
I really like that idea, but what do you see that your students are eating
because if I was
a student, I would have eaten eggs every single meal.
Well, that's one thing that they quickly come to realize is that diet diversity changes pretty quick,
yeah.
and that it's not diverse. You do tend to purchase lower quality food items because they typically tend to be less expensive, but they also tend to be the ones that are ready to go. And there's not a lot of prep time. And unfortunately, eating on a budget and cooking whole foods is possible, but you need the time to do it. And that's what a lot of people don't have, is time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Something that was pretty profound when I first heard it is, as we were talking about like the money part of this nutrition food conversation, there was someone that was in my life that said, yeah, what we spend on groceries is kind of expensive, but we view it as an investment in our health. Like, it's worth it to eat these whole foods. And
mm-hmm.
Do you have anything to say about that? Is that something that you kind of work with people on when they have like money pushbacks? If you were to work with someone, say, do you ever try to do any kind of like I see what you're saying is valid, but do you see how it's worth it to invest a little more and maybe work with your budget so that this can happen instead of going to Starbucks every other day?
Right. Yes and no. I wouldn't say it's something necessarily that is, say, specific to our curriculum in the courses that I teach, but it comes up, you know, in conversation and, you know, how can we work with this? Because the evidence is really clear in terms of the relationship between food and health, long-term health. And so I would say it's not something I specifically teach in my courses, but it definitely comes up in conversation.
I feel like I feel sad that I didn't have you for my core nutrition class. I'm not going to name names, but I was very bored.
Yeah.
It was very boring.
Well, and
it's we've talked about this.
Yeah.
It was a teaching assistant for one of the people at MSU. Okay. So it wasn't even her class. But the assistant, the TA, whatever you want to call it, was god awful. And it was on Tuesdays and Thursdays at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I wanted to pull my hair out.
And that's, I think, with any subject, too. I know, you know, Ed struggles with the same things in accounting, right? That first instructor that you have can make it or break it in terms of interest in the subject matter. And I'm by no means saying that I am amazing at my job, but I hope that I'm passionate about it and that comes across to the students. Because it does make a difference. And to be fair, sometimes there's just some sciencey stuff that you have to get through, you know, before you can talk about all the fun stuff. And, you know, it's kind of, again, finding that balance.
Cool. I feel really excited about this. I feel like there's a lot of stuff that people can pick out of this.
I hope so.
I think that was very good as far as you were so nervous, but I think there's a lot that was said, just even practicals.
Yeah,
I learned things, and I feel fairly comfortable in a grocery store. And when I say fairly, I like barely fairly.
Yeah. I think don't be afraid to ask.
Sure.
You know, ask somebody. Look around. What are your resources? I think, again, that comes back to being scared of doing something and then just choosing not to do it because it's easier. So there, you know, people in the gym here ask me. I'm totally okay answering questions, and you know, if you need resources, I can send them your way. And you know, if you're not in the gym and you're listening and you're in a different city, look for your own local resources. Start at your grocery store, go to the university, go to the community college. You know, a lot of sometimes restaurants will have cooking classes that you can just go. Grocery stores often have cooking classes, actually, that you can just go and sit and watch, you know, and so maybe you learn some different techniques or you learn different ingredients. There are resources out there for sure. You just kind of have to go find them.
So that brings you to my next question, especially for the people locally. If people have questions for you, how do they find you?
They can email me.
What about Instagram?
I'm pretty sheltered on Instagram. Email's probably better. My address through the university is on the MSC website, but it's janet.gamble@montana.edu. You're more than welcome to reach out. Yeah.
Great. Thank you. I feel like really helpful, even for me.
I don't know.
I think
hopefully.
People are going to get a lot out of that.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me.
Yes. Thank you, friend. Have a good rest of your day.
You too.